Have you tried changing your health year on year, resolving that this year things are going to be different, but nothing seems to change? Oftentimes, when things are not changing, we are following many wellness myths and not looking at the full picture, including our nutrition, recovery, stress management, leaving out mind-body connection. I want to introduce you to Wellness Redefined, a new podcast from Rufilion Media that's here to dispel all your myths about wellness and fitness while sharing stories of how we've redefined what it means to be healthy. On each episode, we'll be talking to experts from all walks of life who will share their own unique wellness journey and offer their perspective. I am your host, Tamika Rochester, founder and CEO of Harlem Cycle, a premier wellness space in New York City with a focus on indoor cycling. I've been an advocate for wellness since as early as I can remember. So if this sounds like something that could help change your life, go ahead and pause the show you're listening to and subscribe to Wellness Redefined on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Inclusive Collective, where we bring you the latest news and analysis in people and workplace culture and share stories and learnings of inclusive people, organizations, and innovation. I am your co-host, Nadia Butt. I'm a workplace culture strategist and talent development consultant. And as always, I'm here with my friend Rob Hadley, a people and culture strategist specializing in DE&I and people analytics. What's good, Rob?
Hey, yeah, I forgot to tell you in the, as we were coming into production. So it's great to see you, Nadia.
But you
You said I'm here always. And I was like, wait a minute. Like the wind is blowing at like 60 miles an hour. I've already lost power like a couple of times. So if we...
might disappear.
Yeah. So if I go away for a standard period of time... Yeah, whatever's... Yeah. Well,
I think there's Colorado.
Whatever's happening out west. Yeah, it's all just coming at me right now. So,
oh, no.
So yeah, if for the listener, if you lose me for an extended amount of time, that's because I lost power.
Okay, that's fair. Thanks for letting us know. We'll just resume. We'll just keep rolling, you know?
Yeah.
So, Rob, I wanted to share with you, do you remember that story we had last week around our friends at the North Face where they...
Yes.
Right? Where they, if you take a training as a consumer, you could get 20% off. Well, this was brought to my attention that the company Rent the Runway is giving $1 million in monthly subscriptions to women celebrating career wins on LinkedIn.
Ooh.
Isn't that interesting? So like this, the CEO, Jennifer Hyman, who leads Rent the Runway, she wants to encourage users to lift deserving women and create a virtuous cycle of female empowerment. And, you know, of course, this month is International Women's Month and there was a day. And so I just thought that was really interesting that we're seeing kind of these folks, these organizations kind of play into, you know, what incentives to, you know, celebrate certain things or build a more awareness. And I wanted to share that with you.
It's real money, right? And so they are putting their money where their figurative mouth is, right?
Yeah.
I meant to actually take the North Face challenge or the... No, I didn't get to it. I still want to because there were some comments online that, hey, maybe this is a little bit transactional. If you go do this, then you get something and therefore you're not necessarily really doing the work or you're not necessarily going to internalize some of the learnings. And so, so I went to do it just to see what it was like, what, if it was good, what the expectations were on the other side of that training. Cause as you always say, you can't just train people and expect them to change their behavior forever.
Amanda Carroll says that, not me, but you can't send them to the island of training.
I love that. And that could have been your rave. So we're already one rave ahead.
Exactly.
Yeah. Let's just shut it down. Let's just end it right here.
So what do we got going on this week?
Yeah. So this week on Inclusive Collective, a big fail from Johns Hopkins Medical, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Goldman Sachs is losing women leaders. And we'll chat with guest Tahira Amatul Wadud about protecting the civil liberties of Muslims this Ramadan season. Later, we've got some rants. We got some raves. More raves. But first, let's get to the deets. Nadia, what do you have for us?
All right. So Sherita Golden, the chief DEI officer at Johns Hopkins Medicine, stepped down. She stepped down from her role 2 months after she defined the term privilege
in a monthly newsletter. So that caused some outrage among conservative groups. Golden, I think it's worth just saying like how she described the word privilege. So
sure.
She described it as, quote, a set of unearned benefits given to people who are in a specific social group. Privilege operates on personal, interpersonal, cultural, and institutional levels, and it provides advantages and favors to members of dominant groups at the expense of members of other groups, end quote. She went on to name groups that are granted privilege, providing general examples. Of course, this got in the hands of X, your favorite platform, including people like Elon Musk, who weighed in, and then it just basically became like a witch hunt. So the dean of the medical faculty, the president of Johns Hopkins Medicine, so, you know, like the leadership team responded and not necessarily supported Golden at all, suggesting that the definition of privilege that Golden gave is counter to the values of the institution. Golden later apologized and stepped down. Do you have any reactions or thoughts? I know you kind of discussed this earlier this last week as well.
Yeah, I was really tuned into this one because this is a bad one, Nadia. What Sherita Golden did here was nothing that you and I don't do pretty often, right? We talk about systemic racism. We talk about privilege. We talk about bias and discrimination. And these are basic concerns. And so the definition she gave was nothing outside of the norm. What she did was she named those folks that enjoy privilege in our society. And so the people that repudiated Sherita Golden, her bosses, they didn't have enough understanding of these concepts to even push back. And so that was what was really strange and I think concerning. And so
sure.
I'm sure they got some negative reaction from patients, customers, maybe perhaps donors in to their system. Mm-hmm. So they knew very little.
Alumni.
They immediately caved. Alumni, for whatever reason, because this term, again, has gotten away from us and been redefined in kind of a negative and toxic way. And so, this could happen to you or I, right? And so, Johns Hopkins, in my opinion, and everyone associated with Johns Hopkins should be just completely embarrassed by this. The two men that did this, that backed away, those are the folks that should have been forced to resign because they obviously clearly don't understand what they're doing and they don't understand these concepts. And so they're unqualified to lead that organization, right? And so, and then they also said, we're going to replace Ms. Gould, right? We're going to bring in someone else and we really thank her. Apparently she did a really great job. Like they were, I actually spoke at a DEI forum at Johns Hopkins last year.
Did you use the word privilege?
Probably.
Right.
I probably did. And they said they want to replace her. Nadia, no one with an ounce of self-respect or ability would take that role to work for these two non-leaders, right? Yeah. Would you take that role?
No, I mean, because you're asking folks to conform. I mean, you're essentially asking a DE&I practitioner to conform to the homogenous culture that exists. And that is exactly the opposite of what we're trying to do, is not to build homogenous cultures, right? It's a very disappointing story, disappointing from the leadership perspective. I'm disappointed that we apparently can't have discourse, not only just around like definitions, but we're letting the trolls control what happens on, in workplaces and in academic institutions. What really bothers me, because, I do have a little bit of background as it pertains to academia, and there's several academic articles and journals where seminal scholars define concepts like privilege and power and prejudice and oppression and identity, right? And how I define privilege is very similar. How you define privilege is very similar to how Sherita defines privilege. And so it's just frustrating that DE&I practitioners and learning development professionals and academics can't even have this conversation now without having these feelings of like retribution. It's just all around really disappointing. And I just also want to highlight that like Sherita was doing really great work at Johns Hopkins, right? Like the article went on to say that she doubled the number of groups that address the needs of underrepresented people. She implemented an annual residency recruitment program. Her leaders at Johns Hopkins literally went as far as to say that she was an extraordinary person or described her career as extraordinary. So it's just like, it's just, none of it makes, make it make sense, Rob.
No, no, I think that you hit on so many things. And I think that even one of the interesting things, also disheartening, was that after this, hundreds of people signed a petition in support of Ms. Golden and saying that she did an excellent job and that this is a commonly held definition of privilege. But there was one in the article that I think we both read. It was one of the white employees at Johns Hopkins, a white male, said, I signed it, but I didn't put my name because I was worried about being fired, right? So that's where we're at. But also, sign your name, whoever you are. Sign, like, just sign your name, right?
Just sign,
like,
your name, dude. Be like an ally. Show up.
Yeah, come on. All right, well, thanks for that. That's an awful story. I definitely want to keep track of that because I can't imagine someone taking that job going forward. So
yeah.
Let's talk about our friends on Wall Street. They're our friends. They used to be our friends. Sometimes. Yeah. So according to a story in the Wall Street Journal last week, women aren't getting big jobs at Goldman Sachs, and therefore they're heading for the exits. According to the article, 2/3 of women that were partners at the end of 2018 have left the firm. Currently, no woman runs a division or is a candidate to run one. CEO David Solomon said, advancing women into our most senior ranks is an area we have not accomplished our goals. He said that our longer-term success depends significantly on developing female partners in senior roles. This is one thing that Goldman does better than others. They just own that they're bad sometimes. And at least that is how they're smarter than other firms. That's why they are actually smart enough to be like, we did a bad job, and they don't try to, right? They don't try to hide it.
Sugarcoat it, yeah, right.
Yeah, only 19% of the partners are women, which is up from 16% in 2018. And I guess I'm just surprised. I don't know why. Well, we've been doing this for a couple of years now, and I'm surprised at my own surprise. You're not surprised.
I think I'm surprised at your surprise. Maybe, but no, I'm not surprised. Yeah. And the reason why is because I last year had actually two clients in the investment industry, and they have very similar themes show up in terms of their areas of opportunity. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it pertained to, there's gendered roles. So you're going to see majority of women, not necessarily as investors or as kind of leaders. They're more in administrative, HR, accounting roles. And then there was a lack of women showing up in leadership. And so it's like an industry problem, right? So it's like, it's not just Goldman Sachs. It's an industry led problem. I just don't think we're oftentimes like solving for the right problem. Like, I want to know why these women are leaving, because it doesn't sound like we hire them and we recruit them. We spend a lot of money on them by getting them into the organization, but then like they're leaving voluntarily. So why does this continue to exist where women are leaving this industry? What are those themes? And the solution to me is not fixing the recruiting process or like fix the sourcing step. To me, I think there's probably opportunity in there too. But I think the primary reason here is like, what's the retention concern? Like, why are these people leaving? It's likely that they don't have a conducive environment. There's no succession planning. There's no development plans. There's no lack of flexibility, right? Like, it's oftentimes I remember it being called like a boys' club. Terrible working hours, people feeling burnt out. So
yeah,
all of the above.
The article does point out that that other banks are doing better, right? And it's almost like Goldman is incubating talent for other banks, right? So
yeah, get them
Goldman,
prepared to go leave.
For whatever reason, they're not able to elevate them into these senior roles. They're obviously recruiting amazing talent for women, and because it's Goldman, it has the best brand. In that particular industry, the article points out that the CEO of Citigroup is a woman. The CFO of Bank of America is a woman. So they go through and talk about all these other places where they're doing better than Goldman and Goldman. So it just seems perplexing because they're getting obviously the best talent, and they're not able to keep people keep women in these senior roles. They get the best talent, and then they move on when they're looking for a bigger job. And so And so it is just interesting. And I think that he's, I think that David Solomon's right. That it is really important, their longer term success and staying and remaining the most relevant brand in terms of banking on Wall Street is related to, do they do a better job in this regard?
That's fair. I mean, there might be some other organizations that are doing better than Goldman, but I still think there's an industry-wide lack of women in leadership roles or just succession planning for women to kind of advance their career and their development, right, within the industry. So
they're not crushing it. Yeah,
they're not the ones crushing, crushing it. Yeah, they're not better. Crushing it. They're doing better, but they're not
they're doing
crushing
better
it.
Than 19%.
Right? Yeah, exactly. So. Yeah. You know, it'll be interesting to see what types of problem solving they do to retain the women and get them into different roles, leadership roles. So we'll see. Yeah. We'll keep an eye on.
Call us.
Yeah. Call us, Goldman Sachs. Well, thanks for that, Rob. That's it for the deets. We'll be right back with our guest, Tahira Amatelwadu. Welcome back, folks. This week on Inclusive Collective Podcast, we welcome Executive Director of CARE Massachusetts and Chief Legal Officer Tahira Amatelwadu. Tahira is a highly respected attorney based in Massachusetts with over 16 years of experience in corporate, family, and civil rights law, a former staff attorney with Western Massachusetts Community Legal Aid. Before entering private practice, she served as a commissioner with the Massachusetts Commission on the Status of Women from 2014 to 2020. In 2016, she rose to national prominence, serving as the principal attorney on behalf of the residents of a community in New York and an anti-Muslim conspiracy theorist who had planned a violent attack against the community. In recognition of her service, she was named a top woman of law by Massachusetts Lawyers Weekly. And in 2021, she received the prestigious Massachusetts Bar Association Community Service Award. She's currently the executive director of CARE, Council on American Islamic Relations, of Massachusetts, where their mission is to enhance the understanding of Islam, encourage dialogue, protect civil liberties, empower American Muslims, and build coalitions that promote social justice and mutual understanding. Welcome, Tahira. Thanks for joining us during the month of Ramadan.
Ah, you're welcome. Thank you for having me. Ramadan Mubarak.
Ramadan Mubarak.
Tahira, it's so great to meet you. Ramadan Mubarak to you. And as Nadia said, thanks for being with us this holiday season. Can you start with your background? Just tell us a little bit about yourself and then how you ended up working with CARE.
All right. Well, nice to meet you as well, Rob, and Ramadan Mubarak to you as well. So my background is that I am I'm Muslim. I am African-American with roots rooted in the slave trade. My parents became Muslim when I was a toddler. So I was raised as Muslim, and I think of myself as second generation consecutive Muslim, with my children being third, second generation consecutive African-American Muslims here in the country, and how special that is. I remember just being a little girl and always loving to talk and, you know, those kids that when the relatives come over, they're doing like shows and performances and that. Yeah,
you were that person.
I was definitely that girl. And the fact that my grandparents and parents and aunts and uncles entertain me actually is making my nose sweat. I'm like, I'm actually having secondhand embarrassment. But you asked me, how did I get here? And part of how I got here is because I have always liked being able to tell the stories of people. Mm-hmm. I've loved being in front of the public. And so I just took a career track that allowed me to do that. I got my bachelor's degree in paralegal studies. I worked in corporate America as a paralegal and in the energy industry as a paralegal before becoming a lawyer at Legal Aid. And something special about being the only Muslim lawyer around these parts made it such that people were calling me for help to do things that other lawyers couldn't or wouldn't do. Mm. And one thing led to another. I became a board member for CARE and then eventually the executive director 2 years ago. So that's from performing in the living room for my grandparents to now being on wonderful podcast and serving the Muslim community. That's how I got here.
I love it.
Straight line.
Yeah. The entertainment is real. I love it.
Yeah.
So Tahira, I have, you know, known about CARE for several years. Of course, CARE Massachusetts website, there's several kind of arms or branches that you folks kind of work on through advocacy, education, voter registration, resources, volunteer work, et cetera. Can you tell us a little bit more about the different types of projects that your team is focused on right now? Any interesting kind of information that you'd like to share with our group, with our listeners around the great work that you folks are focused on?
Thank you. Yeah, we have a great team. We currently have three staff members. It's myself, Barbara Dugan, who's our legal director, and Fatuma Muhammad, who's the outreach coordinator, youth advocacy coordinator. And we're currently hiring three more people. So I'm really excited about how the small chapter is growing. The projects on our desk right now really stem from what the community is telling us it needs post October 7th. And so at this moment, we are working to make sure that people are prepared to engage in legislative advocacy, that they know how to engage in legislative advocacy. What's really popular right now from the civics aspect of things is the municipal ceasefire resolutions and watching those be passed in the cities and towns throughout the Commonwealth is really exciting, and being able to be a resource for people when they want that. We continue to advocate before our state reps and our congressional representatives. And of course, that's what the community loves to be able to do as well. And finally, what Fatuma's doing is some of our foundational work of supporting the youth and making sure that they have a great agenda for our upcoming youth leadership programs, which will happen later in the summer. And most importantly right now is our attention to the research and bullying report that we do every other year for high school kids to see how Muslim students are experiencing public and charter schools. We do that every other year. So we're in the data collection phase right now. And yeah, it's starting to slant towards, not unsurprisingly, that Muslim students are having a very hard time in the public and charter schools. So those are the things that if you came and looked at our desk, you would see.
Interesting. Yeah, and there's obviously a lot of work to do. Obviously the students thing is something that is, you know, super valuable. I was thinking about workplaces and just what is going on in workplaces. What are you particularly paying attention to? Are there either legislative actions being taken to protect Muslims in the workplace during this, you know, very tough and difficult time? And then are you seeing an uptick in complaints from Muslims in terms of discrimination, harassment, retaliation?
Yes, all of that. We logged record-breaking numbers by the end of 2023 for complaints of harassment, discrimination, even violence against Muslims. So let's look at this in two ways. The theme, so to speak, that people are complaining about is the silencing of Muslims around the issues of Palestine, the issues of speaking out against the foreign government, i.e. Israel, and the deep, swift, serious punishment that people are experiencing when they do so. And that is coming largely towards those who have a high profile. So you'll see that among students. You'll see that among Harvard students, right? We know that they got hit very, very hard and very quickly. You also see that amongst the Muslim medical professional community, who also have higher profiles, of course, in society. Doctors enjoy a status. And it seems like they were targeted for this level of vitriol. And what that is looking like is it's doxing, it's harassment, it's stalking. And some of it is actually interfering with their workplace environment, where you'll have coordinated efforts by people to contact the employer of that medical professional and complain about them to the point where it's such a distraction that the Muslim medical provider is being separated from their employment because of it. So it's not an exaggeration to call it a crisis level that we're dealing with here in Massachusetts. And it's also reflective of what's happening around the country.
Is this, you had said record-breaking, but I'm curious, like, what were some of the examples prior to October 7th? Like, what your office, you know, obviously exists for a reason. I'm assuming other than awareness and education and advocacy, were you receiving phone calls from people in the workplace also prior to October 7th that where folks, Muslim employees, needed support or were experiencing discrimination? And what did that look like? What were some of those examples that of folks calling in, and how has that shifted?
Yeah. So in 2022, we had a record-breaking number, or maybe it wasn't a record-breaking number, but it was the largest complaint was made by public and charter school students, Muslim students. Mm-hmm. So in Massachusetts, the greatest indicator of Islamophobia was happening to children mm-hmm. in 2022, more than their parents. Mm-hmm. It was happening to children. And that was seen in two ways. It was seen in very harsh discipline of boys with things that kids might say on platforms. And then all of a sudden, the Muslim boy is suspended for a couple of days mm-hmm. very quickly. This is very quick, the way this punishment works. And it's usually because he's Muslim identifying, has a Muslim name. And what you'll always see is that there is a child in that group, because there's always a group, who is not Muslim, who is likely white, who did not get the same treatment. But the Muslim kid, Ahmed, is definitely going to be suspended for 3 days. Mm. Then you would see that Muslim girls were in trouble or suffering because they wore hijab, and the school would either enforce unfair policies against them if they had a uniform and say this was non-uniform, or if the girl was targeted and then she hit back, pushed back, yelled back, she'd be disciplined for unruly behavior. So those are the things that we saw in 2022. And in the workforce, you had some of the typical things, some discrimination, failure to promote or to hire because someone thought they were Muslim or Muslim identifying or immigrant, requests for accommodations not always being honored that we would have to go in and give them some support on. Mm-hmm. So some of the more what you would think of as normal experiences that Muslims have, that's what we were dealing with. But the alarm had been sounded around the children, and it continues to be an issue post October 7th, but it is outweighed by the severity of what their parents are experiencing in the workforce.
Yeah, you touched on something that I thought was interesting, the request for accommodation, I think, particularly in the workplace. And I think about this yes. time of the year, I'm always surprised that we're not more progressive in not learning. Which is on me for not learning that this is the way things go. But what has there been any progress in terms of accommodation for people in the workplace around Ramadan? Right.
Yeah, I am so glad I did my homework. Barbara Dugan, our legal director, loves to write these guides. And I just edited one last night, and it's up on our website about accommodations for employees in the workplace. And so what we're telling people is, one, let's just be practical. Whatever it is that you need, try to see if you can problem solve yourself. So if you need to leave a little early, you need to change a shift, you need a longer break time because you're making a salat or you're breaking fast, see if your colleagues can cover it for you, mm-hmm. Present it to your employer and ask for their accommodation. In general, in Massachusetts, employers are expected to honor a reasonable accommodation so long as it doesn't bring the factory to a halt. That's right. Not the legal standard, but essentially is what it is. Yeah. And it's really rooted in practicality and common sense. And we advise people to use both in making the request, but to make the request and not to sort of suffer in silence or not exercise your Islamic right to be Muslim or to have those accommodations. We also give some advice around asking for time off for Eid holiday. Mm-hmm. And what have you. So I think people are pretty resourceful at this point. Mm-hmm. So we only are getting calls when they've tried those things and it didn't work. Mm-hmm. But yeah. I think we have a community that knows generally it's right and just wants some reinforcement that what they're asking for makes sense.
I'm curious if like with the what sticking to like this accommodations during Ramadan or for Eid, I'm curious if there if you've seen, because the level of awareness has increased, obviously, specifically since, you know, 2020, say. And I'm curious if you're still surprised about receiving calls from employees that maybe they didn't get the support or they felt discriminated against. Does that continue to surprise you as there's so many resources available to employers now and there's so many kind of legal lawsuits around the discrimination and what they can and should do? What does like any of that surprise you ever? I'm just curious, like from a lawyer's perspective, like what is what's going on?
From a lawyer's perspective and from a cynical perspective, I think you can look at complaints in two ways. One is just the employer didn't know or was ill-advised. And you'll see that in how they're speaking to the employee or what they say. And you'll just say, oh, they don't know that they have to do this or this is expected. And then there are some who just have animus or hostility. And you could also see that. And that's where you know in your gut that they are hostile in some way. And where they decide they're going to draw a line and make me. If I will do this, if you make me. And so we do have some of that. I'm never surprised as much as I am frustrated and disappointed by the latter.
Yeah. And these are civil rights issues, right? I mean, these are big risks for, like, I would think in that scenario when the employer is hostile, yes. It's a risk for the employer, right?
Yes, it's a risk for the employer. I will say that in my experience, state government employers can be some of the more difficult to navigate.
Oh,
schools can be some of the more difficult to navigate. And there's a number of reasons. I think sometimes they don't have a PR pressure that we might have if it's a private firm, or they may feel that they are within the law and what you're asking for might take them right up to, we don't have to go all the way there. Mm-hmm. But if you sue us and we're told to do it, we'll accommodate that. So that's frustrating. And I don't know what to do about that other than it forces, you know, the parties into long litigation and a possible accommodation or change in the law.
Sure. Sure. Tahira, before we wrap up, I want to shift gears because I wanted to ask you in particular, because I recognize that one, it's Ramadan, and two, it has been quite the year. It's actually been quite the 5 or 6 years. but it's been, you've been busy. And how do you experience joy during this Ramadan this year in particular? And then how do you encourage other Muslims in America to celebrate and still find joy during this Ramadan, even though it is weighing pretty heavy on a lot of American Muslims right now?
On all of it. All of it. So the way I find joy is there was a practice that we started during COVID where we would start making iftar. We were breaking fast, I think, a little earlier, but by 4 o'clock. So no matter where I was, probably home, I wanted to be cooking at 4 o'clock. And I just found that that was really grounding for me. Mm-hmm. Now life is so much more busy, but I still try to hold to that 4 o'clock. Like, where am I at 4 o'clock in Ramadan so that I can be established for the kids and that I can start to wind down my work responsibilities so that I can be more spiritual and present? Mm-hmm. And that's a trick that I've developed. It doesn't always manifest, mm-hmm. but I have to just tell you that it forces me to be more present and to remind myself that we are entitled to joy. We are entitled to center our relationship with God and our community, even when things are tough and sad and difficult. That is when we need it the most. And for me, it's that 4 o'clock hour that I force myself into that mode. And I ask people or suggest that people consider finding that point in the day where they too go a little quiet, become more reflective, and give themselves a sense of peace and joy in that 24-hour period.
I love that. Great reminder.
That is brilliant. I think everyone can take that and do something with that piece of advice. So I really appreciate that. I wish we could end there, but I'm bound to ask you for a resource for our audience, something that you would share. So you already gave us one from CARE as well, but anything that you think that people should be tuning into right now and that would help them navigate some of the things that we're talking about.
So yes, our website, the CARE website, is chock full of good resources, not just for employees, but also for students, K through 12 and college students. I'm enjoying the Yakin Institute 30 for 30, where there's reflections on each chapter of Holy Quran each night. And I appreciate those. And so I think there are no limit of resources in the community. And I encourage people to find what works for them. I also look forward to visiting different masajid and breaking fast in community, which I love. And there's a number of interfaith iftars happening also that people should try to avail themselves to, because you'll see all of your neighbors of all faiths and those of no faith just coming together and, just being in unity at this moment.
I love that reminder for the interfaith. So appreciate that, folks. You could probably check out your local mosques near you that have those interfaith iftars. Which is really great to get to know your community a little bit more. So yeah. Tahira Amatal Wadud, thank you so much for joining us this week on Inclusive Collective.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Stay with us, folks. We'll be right back for our Conflections and Raves and Rants.
Welcome back to Inclusive Collective. Nadia, we just finished speaking with guest Tahira Amatal Wadud. Nadia, first of all, Tahira was transcendent. Loved speaking with her. What did you think? What did you take away?
Every time I speak to her, I know her. She's a family friend. Every time I speak with her, I feel like I just learn something new regarding our community, and particularly in Massachusetts, the Muslim community. I just really appreciate her being transparent with what she's working on. Really serious stuff, right? Just what's happening in school systems and then what's happening in communities as it relates to folks supporting what's going on in the world right now. But then I also really appreciate her talking about some of the fun educational things that they're doing and working on, and just legislatively some of the work that they're doing, Massachusetts state government. And I think, because CARE has different chapters across the country, mm-hmm. I believe every kind of chapter has its own support system and working relations with their legislative branch. So I just always, this is my study. This is my passion around the research that I'm doing as part of my doctoral study. So it's I geek out on this stuff. But what about you? I mean, it may not be fun as what I think,
It takes a special person. Obviously, a lot of the things that she's dealing with are heavy. And it even breaks your heart, even just speaking about some of the things that happen to students in a generalized sense. You're thinking about what that means on a personal level. And so it takes a special person to do that work. And so, very lucky to have her. And I just loved what she talked about in terms of trying to center yourself at a particular time. I thought that was brilliant. I thought that was something that everyone should try to think about that if at all possible. And obviously, like she said, life gets away from you, but just even thinking attaching that centering to a time of the day, I thought was really brilliant. And I think I'm gonna re-listen to that segment and see if I can take away something from that.
Yeah, totally. You're right. You don't have to be a Muslim to reflect, right? And to think about your day and think about what happened. So that's great. Yeah, thank you, Tahira, for joining. Let's get to the rants and raves. So, Rob, you're going to kick us off.
Let's do this. I've been waiting all episode.
All week. No, oh,
so,
all right.
So just another check-in. I've done a rant on this before. And so we're talking about the rhetoric around the forced sale of or the banning of TikTok. And so the House of Representatives here in the U.S. passed a bill giving TikTok 6 months to separate from the app's parent company, ByteDance, which is owned by China. And I just want to point out that in those hearings, House Republicans' biggest fear of TikTok is what is the fact that it promotes un-American values, right? Oh, okay. And so without
hypocrisy,
without any irony that their own candidate for president tried to steal an election, has argued in court the right to murder his political opponents, and who openly adores a certain Russian dictator who is also addicted to social media, right? So, you know, no one thought of these things as they worried about the un-American values that TikTok promotes. All at the same time, they're making life more difficult for our Asian American friends. It was just last month that Senator Tom Cotton questioned TikTok CEO about his membership in the CCP, even though he kept telling him that he's from Singapore.
Yeah, like, so again, he's so dumb, Tom Cotton. You can't.
So it's fine to regulate TikTok. I have no like overt affection for TikTok, but you know, make sure that we
don't do turning down
the rhetoric. What's that?
You don't do those TikTok dances with your son?
Not yet. But and maybe never now. But you know, make sure that we're paying attention to the rhetoric and try to do it in a least or in a less racist way, for sure.
Sure. That's a great rant. I know you've been waiting to talk about that all episodes. So appreciate that. Let's end on a fun note. I thought this was this didn't really make headline news, but I found it in Al Jazeera and I thought it was worth sharing. So a UAE first female astronaut will graduate from or has graduated from a NASA training program in Houston. Nora Al Matushi is an Emirati mechanical engineer and has graduated as part of the NASA astronaut class of 2023. She and her classmates will now be eligible for space missions, including to the International Space Station, as well as any other future U.S.-led missions, such as trips to the moon. Just really fun stuff seeing like a hijab-wearing woman from, you know, Arab woman from the Middle East in NASA in the training program and maybe, you know, head to the moon one day. I thought that was really cool to share during the month of Ramadan.
Amazing. Love that. Nadia, we got anything to plug?
Do we have anything to
plug? I think so. I think we're plug free. All right, we'll wrap it up there. Inclusive Collective is a production of Aphelion Media and edited by RMFA. We'd love to hear from you. Send us your feedback at inclusivecollective@aphelion.com. You can also find us on LinkedIn, YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok. Have we posted anything on TikTok for a while, Nadia?
No, not really. I should get back on that, huh?
Yeah. It's Seems like it's really popular.
Yeah,
People love it. Be sure to follow up with us on LinkedIn so you can subscribe to the Eyes Heat monthly newsletter. If you like what you heard, be sure to subscribe and rate us wherever you get your podcast. Thanks again to our guest, Tahira Amatul Wakdud. Nadia, thanks so much.
Ramadan Mubarak.
America, we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. By honoring your career calling, you impact your family, your friends, and your community. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.